Welcome to another episode of Adoption, The Making of Me.
I'm Louise Brown.
And I'm Sarah Reinhart.
Make sure to find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as Adoption, The Making of Me podcast.
You can also find us at our website, adoptionthemakingofme.com.
And please remember to subscribe, share, and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. In today's episode, we will be discussing Susan Keo Ito's I Would Meet You Anywhere, and then we will be airing an episode from season one, John. Once in a while, we like to highlight past guests that maybe fell through the cracks, you know, for people who jump in later. So here's John, episode from the past.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Louise.
I'm always like, who's going to say hi
first? I know. We've gotten into such a, you know, little routine with CNN and another great episode. And hi, Sarah. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Sarah. Hi, Louise.
So we're talking about our Patreon Zoom group, which is just building and growing and so good. So our next one is Saturday, March 2nd.
No, it's April 2nd.
No, because we're in February.
Oh, you're right. You're right. March 2nd.
March 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern time.
1 p.m. Eastern, people. And I'll tell you what, the last time we joined, it just is like exciting to get up on a Saturday morning and join. Like, I'm going to go have coffee with the tightest group. It's cool.
Yeah.
So it will feel that way for people.
So if you want to become part of our Patreon Zoom, monthly Zoom, if you become a $10 or higher Patreon, you can join the Zoom. Also, we have some cool merch stuff.
We do.
At the Patreon levels, yeah.
We do.
All sorts of stuff.
We have also, and if you go to our merch store, we even have more than just t-shirts and sweatshirts. We have like a thing for your phone, so you can have at mom on your phone. We have a pillow, a blanket, all sorts of. Cuddle
Patreon,
us at night.
if you join at the $15 level, you get a mug and you get to join the Patreon Zoom every month. And then at the $20 level, you get a t-shirt and you get to join. So take a look at it. Go to Patreon.
Yeah.
And look for us.
See you soon.
See you soon.
Sarah.
Hey, Louise.
I beat you to it. Hello,
you did. And here we are for a discussion of Susan Keo Ito's I Would Meet You Anywhere. We are on the chapter Just a Bee Sting and then Fairy Queen after that.
Yeah, gosh. Susan, I was just telling Sarah off camera that's sad, just a bee sting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she went through her earlier problems with pregnancy and now is pregnant with a little boy.
And gets preeclampsia.
Yeah, preeclampsia.
Ooh, which is so
friends with
scary.
That.
Yeah.
It is scary. And she had to get her, you know, get her little boy to a certain amount of weeks. And it was between her life and the little boy.
That's what it
Samuel.
Came down
to.
Yeah, or Samuel.
Samuel.
Right? Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, then it's a big loss for her and her husband, which brings up all her stuff, right? I mean, losing a baby. I thought of my mother.
This was now her second pregnancy that ended the same way. Different reasons, obviously, but ending in the same way. So
it was interesting, too, because I thought of my mom, Mary Lee, my mom who raised me, and she had to deliver a baby full term and bury it and stuff. And I was thinking about bury her. I was thinking about how this affected Susan. You know, in it, I was thinking of that. And even how she said, well, we thought about adoption and then they got pregnant. Mm-hmm. Because that's the mindset. Like, I thought about adoption a lot, actually, when my ex-husband and I didn't get pregnant right away. And so, you know, I didn't have that. I kind of felt the same. I can be the one that would know how to talk to them.
Right.
I could just mess them up more.
Even though, you know, total pre-understanding of the trauma, right? Oh, I can.
I'll just mess them up more than my biological.
And then she ends up having two daughters.
Yeah.
Not too far apart in ages. And
So
ultimately they're, but still thought about Samuel, you know, as you would.
I was thinking how she had such a healthy marriage and relationship early on.
I know.
Because I feel like I'm in a healthy relationship and a very healthy marriage now. But I think she did a lot of work very young, even though she wasn't like simply, you know, how she is now, how we are at this age. But she really, I didn't tackle any of this. And so.
Also, I think, you know, her parents were so open with her. And I think that.
Makes a difference.
I don't know. It's anecdotal, but I think had her parents been maybe like your parents weren't as open at that time. So you didn't feel free.
Yes.
You know, I think that probably really helped her. And then
I agree.
And, you know, she had two parents together, so she created a healthy relationship.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had the best circumstances under the circumstances. You know what I mean?
I do. I feel like I had that too, but I didn't have the openness. And the openness is big with adoption.
Because it is.
I had the openness.
Not,
we know we're
not
adopted.
Feeling guilty.
But not feeling guilty.
Not putting guilt on you. You know, it's a heavy, heavy responsibility.
Yeah. It just was such that era, right? I'm hoping it's changing. I really do. There was a couple little parts that I highlighted. I don't know if you did in this, but.
In Dairy Queen, the next one?
No, in this one. Only because when she told Yumi that she was going in to have this done, maybe.
Yes.
She said, this is Yumi speaking. I'm sure everything will be fine. Her voice was flat, gentle. She didn't offer to fly out to California. I wondered about the stroke. If I really had one, would that bring her to my bedside? I caught a glimmer of understanding of what it meant to parent and seeing for the first time that as much as I longed for it, this is not what she was, not to me.
You know, it probably triggered a bunch of stuff for Yumi as well.
I'm sure. The whole thing made me think this is the loss in adoption because her adopted parents, of course, her parents that she was said, let's come right away. What can we do? Let me be there. They're parenting her. The one she's longing for is not, then you're caught in the middle still with your weird feelings and you've lost a baby. It's like bad.
Yeah, it's so complicated. And
her writing's so good about it.
I know. And then the next chapter, she jumps back to after she met Mika, her half-sister, who has her name. I always have to say that.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. And then Mika, she talks about how Mika's in a delicate position, trying to appease both Yumi and Susan. And I think the siblings get lost sometimes in the conversation.
Yes.
You know,
appreciated that because she's like, I'm graduating. Come to my graduation party, sister. You know, how cool to be invited. But don't tell anybody who you are. Of course, all my friends know.
Right. And was it Mika that told her not to say anything? I think.
Yes.
I think it. Because of Yumi, not because
of Yumi.
Yeah.
But yeah, and she's so then, like, all my friends know, but I have to, she's the go-between, right?
And Susan sees, you know, so she gets into Yumi's house and she spends the night in her house. And, you know, Yumi's husband is very welcoming. And then her picture is everywhere. And then yet the brother doesn't know a thing about her. And they, you know, she finally said, well, what about Kai? Is that his name, Kaz?
Yeah, I think so, Kaz.
Kaz. And they're like, well, he never asked.
So we just have
here's this random stranger's pictures all throughout my house.
She must
the night.
Sense
She's going to my sister's graduation. Never asks. You know, which kind of shows you like the secretive, you know, it's just all secrets. And
I can tell you that I have a child who probably would have never asked if I didn't spell something out. He'd be like, I don't want to know. I don't know what's happening. So it's like... It's so weird. No one tells him.
He's barely there. He doesn't go to the party. He's like, and then they have the graduation party and Mika's friends are like looking.
Yeah.
Because they know, you know, like, aha, this is her. You know,
and she looks like her.
Yes.
Don't they do a group picture too? The son is leaving. And
they cheesed. 1, 2, 3, cheese.
he sits on the couch
and,
the, like,
and they're
okay.
Just like, you know, nice to meet you. He's like, yeah, you too. And then he's, you know, he's out of there.
Because Yumi wanted a picture of all her kids together. She just doesn't tell one of them that that's her kid.
Yeah. Like, oh, gosh. Well, more will be revealed in the next.
It will. It was levity.
In the next chapter, I'm sure.
I can't wait. So we'll be reading I Would Meet You at a Wedding. And then the next one, that's pretty short. We'll be reading Origami.
Thunder. Is it? Oh, that is very short. Do we want to do another one?
Sure.
Let's do three.
So we'll read all the way through Undertow and we'll see you soon. for John.
We'll see you in a minute.
See you in a minute.
Don't forget our little catchphrases, Louise. We've got merchandise with our catchphrases.
See you in a minute, merchandise. Come on.
See you in a minute, merchandise. Okay.
I'm really excited to have our guest. He's a friend of mine here in Kansas City, and I know his story, and I think you guys are all going to be really just blown away by it. So, John Fry, how are you?
Hi. I'm really, really excited to be a part of what you guys are doing. I think that, you know, has the chance to be helpful to a lot of people. I'm very thankful that you guys have asked me to be a part of this. So, my name's John, and I'm a 47-year-old. I'm adopted, so I guess that's the general theme here is, you know, adoption, right? And I was adopted and brought to the United States when I was about a year and a half old. Actually, what's funny is before Sarah and Louise asked me to come onto this, I called my mom, my adopted mother, last weekend. And I told her that I was going to be coming onto this podcast and I wanted to get some information from her, but I also wanted to kind of let her know, hey, there's going to be some things that maybe if you happen to listen to this podcast might be difficult to hear, but, you know, like, first of all, like, I want you to know that, like, I absolutely love you and want you to know that things that I may say in there, they may come across as hurtful, but I still want you to know I love you and that this is something I've, you know, need to do. So it was kind of like I almost was calling to her to kind of get her permission. And she was good with it. You know, me and my mother have had a strained relationship up until about 6 years ago. So anyway, I was adopted when I was a year and a half old. I was brought here from Vietnam as part of something called Operation Baby Lift. What happened was at the end of the Vietnam War, the South was had fallen to the North, and Saigon was, you know, was the capital of the South, and the Northern were marching in. And so I don't know who hatched the idea, but there was this idea that we are going to put a bunch of babies into airplanes and then fly them out of Vietnam and scatter them across the world, right? And, you know, if you read about it, it's kind of controversial because some people will say it was the largest mass adoption event in the world. And then some people will say it was the largest mass kidnapping in the world. I was one of those children. There was about 3,000 of us. I happened to be at the time when I was, before I was brought to the United States, I was in an orphanage in it's referred to as Ho Chi Minh City, but it was Saigon at the time. And I was at an orphanage that was run by World Vision. And World Vision's still around. They're a huge organization. I believe they do a lot of good things in the world. Essentially, I was at this orphanage in Saigon at least twice. The first time I was there, I had a pneumonia, but then somewhere in the records, it shows that somebody came back and got me and brought me home. And then at some point I was returned to the orphanage. And I think you have to understand that at the time during the war, I mean, there was a scarcity of food. If you're a mother trying to raise a child or having a baby in that type of situation, there's not a lot of opportunities to take care of your child. And so I think from what I understand was that the orphanages were kind of like safe havens for children.
That's why some people consider it the kidnapping, because there's bombs going off everywhere. They have no food. So they put the babies there to be safe and would come back and forth.
Yeah. It wasn't like an orphanage like you think of maybe like Annie or right. Oliver Twist, right? We certainly weren't singing, you know. But anyhow, so you had these orphanages there. And like I said, I believe from my understanding is that families would take their children there because it was where they knew that they could get healthcare, be safe, you know, they could get fed. At some point, I got gathered up with the rest of these children, right? And this was a feel-good story that would, like, you know, was a humanitarian effort. We're going to come in here and save babies, right? The U.S. had gotten their asses kicked. This was kind of a way to, like, save some face and go out on a high note, right? You know, if you read the stories, the first plane that went out of Saigon with babies on it crashed. And half of the passengers died. You know, it was like children, babies, children, and, you know, crew members. So that was kind of a setback, obviously. But then I guess the subsequent airlifts out of that were successful. So I was on an airplane, and most of the children out of Vietnam went to either, my understanding was, United States, Canada, France, Australia, and maybe Great Britain, I think, developed countries, you know, first world countries. What happened was, this is something I've known about all my life. Like I knew this story, but it wasn't until about 6 years ago that I decided that I was going through painful transition. And part of that transition was due to my deferred emotional maintenance. There were things a long time ago that I should have dealt with that made me who I am now, but also wounded me in such a way that, you know, I wasn't able to be, I guess, present or be the person I wanted to be, especially in relationships, right? With, like my wife. So I decided about 6 years ago that I was going to go full bore into looking into, you know, my adoption and where I came from, because I just like on a whim decided, you know what, I'm going to go back to Vietnam, because that's where it seemed like, you know, maybe some of these questions will be answered and maybe I can get some closure, right? So if I go back to Vietnam and do this, that I would somehow mend some of those things that were hurting inside me for so long, right? So, and I think I've listened to yours and, your guys' podcast, and I've read other stories. And so I think adopted children, you know, I suffer from very similar things that a lot of adopted children from, you know, like mine manifests themselves like an abandonment issues, being able to be emotionally connected to people. It's like, I want to be emotionally connected. I want to be close to people. But then yet as soon as that happens, you know, it's like you want to drink from a water fountain, but instead when it is present to you, you're being drowned by a fire hydrant, right?
Yeah.
Just so much. And you just don't have a way to, for me at least, I don't have a way to process it. I used to not be able to have a way to process it, right? So I decided I was going to go back to Vietnam and work on my shit by going and like, you know, trying to reconnect with this place that I left 46 years ago, 45 years ago. What happened was when I started going down that road, I did two things. I contacted World Vision because I wanted to see if there's any records, right, of when, how I got to the United States, which cargo plane I came on. They were bringing children in through various entry points and stuff like that. What happened was I called World Vision and I met the guy who's the archivist for World Vision, and he's a historian and archivist. And he was, I told him my name and I told him my date of birth and stuff. And so he was able to kind of go back and find some tidbits, not like there was no smoking gun. So basically I found out, you know,
Find out your name, your birth name? I did.
So my first name in Vietnamese is Lee, L-Y. So I became naturalized. When I was adopted, I was here in the States until I was about 7. And then my parents went ahead and naturalized me, right? And so on my naturalization papers, my birth name's on there. And so I kind of had that, you know, going for me. And then I contacted this archivist and he was able to find out which plane I was on.
Wow.
And there was some like records that showed that I was actually not born in Saigon, but I was actually born in a decently sized city that's south, Canada. And so that's where it showed that I was born at.
Was that, but were you in the orphanage there or were you in an orphanage in Saigon?
I was in the orphanage in Saigon. So somehow somebody who brought me up to Saigon made that journey up. You know, when I was in Vietnam, I took a bus ride from Saigon down to Canada, and it was probably a 2-hour drive, right? You know, in a bus on a, you know, this is like modern roads now and stuff like that. So it's not during a war. So
it must have been a huge journey. Yeah.
So I have no idea how the folks that, you know, got me up to where I was at there, right? So that's where I was apparently born at. And this gentleman, he put me in contact with this woman, and her name's Elsie, I believe is her name. She was, her and her husband were in Vietnam around the same time that I was there. And I think maybe maybe the same orphanage that I was in. Now, I don't think our times that, you know, like overlapped, but she was there, you know, at some point. And her husband, because her husband, if I remember right, her husband worked for World Vision, and she was either a volunteer or a nurse at the orphanage where I believe that I was at.
That's insane. God.
Wow. Let me ask you quickly, did you find out what cargo plane you were on and where it went, and then how you ended up?
Yeah, so to a lesser extent, yes.
So you grew up where?
Well, okay, so what happened?
I know, but our audience doesn't.
Okay, so here's what happened. My parents, Liz and Jerry Fry, they're from the Midwest here. They somehow ended up in California, of all places, and were living in Irvine at the time. And they did not believe they could have children, right? So this is a common trope amongst adopted children, right? Like,
yes.
If you want to have kids of your own, adopt a kid, right? Like, So they had been unsuccessful in having children. And so they had started the adoption process. Not the Operation Baby Lift, like, you didn't start the adoption process like knowing Operation Baby Lift was going to happen, right?
Right.
It was just like, we were already like, so they'd already been vetted because they had already gone through the adoption process. You know, my dad likes to tell me stories like, you know, like guys would show up and dig through their trash, right? Like, so they're like doing background.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So my mom and dad were already gone down the road of trying to adopt a child. And then if I remember correctly, talked to my mother, you know, they basically, when Operation Baby Lift kind of came on, they basically called my parents up and they gave them a very short amount of time. They're like, all right, do you guys want a kid? Okay, we've got a kid. He's coming, right? He's like, on a plane right now, you know, or like, and they didn't even know if it was going to be a boy or girl. It's like, we have a children. We have, like, you know, the stork is coming, right? And so,
literally out of the sky.
Yes, like literally coming, right? And so I came into the US, and that's where the timeline's a little vague. I was about a year and a half old when I got here. And then I was in maybe one or two foster homes briefly, you know, like maybe like I would probably measure those in like weeks, you know, weeks or months, not, you know, like, and so I believe that my mother and father finally, you know, took me in when I was, you know, probably like maybe 20 months old at the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the clothes I was wearing were like, you know, like, I guess just whatever they had, you know, to give children. Whenever they got here. And so my mother thought, you know, she told me the story that when I came in there, I had these huge feet. Like it was like, you know, so here I am like almost like not quite a 2 year old, a little bit less than a 2 year old, but like I was wearing like shoes that were like, you know, like four or five size bigger than me. And then come to find out what it was is they just put the wrong, like they put like, you know,
threw some shoes on.
Yeah. Whatever shoes I could find. Right. So I will say that when I first met my mother and father, for the first time, I guess I went to my father first, you know, like I went to hug my father first instead of hugging my mother. And I've always got, you know, I think that maybe hurt my mom's feelings. Right. And so
like set the tone or something.
Possibly, you know,
well, she's a mom who can't have a baby. She's waiting for this baby. The baby comes, you know, and she's so excited. And then that's that, you know?
Yeah. When my mom finally listens to this, we'll probably have to have a talk about this again, right?
Right.
So my brother, James, he came along. So I was born in 73. He was born in 76, July of 76. So,
and he has not.
And Operation Baby Lift didn't happen until 75, right?
Yes. Yes.
So you had about a year or
so. Yes, a yearish, you know, I think, you know, I don't know. But yeah, something like that. That I was I was the only child there for a while.
Right? And your brother's not adopted.
No. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. So my brother, I have a younger brother. His name's James, and he's about a year and a half. No, he's like 3 years younger than me, and 2.5, 3 years younger. And then I have a sister named Sarah. Also, she spells it without an H, and she she's about 5 years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. So.
And you're the oldest. That's interesting.
I am. And so I always felt that being the oldest and being there before my brother and sister actually made it easier, I think, to blend with them. You know, like, it wasn't like the family was established before I got there. You know, I was there before they were there.
Yeah.
So I think growing up, they saw me as just one of them, right? Yeah.
The older brother.
Which is...
Speaking of blending, though, that's a word I wanted to was the fact that you were from a different country, an entirely different culture, at all ever addressed or talked about or anything? Like,
no, I mean, just it was talked, like, it was just like a matter of fact, you know, just like, just you're from Vietnam, you know. I could have been from, you know, I could have been from Vietnam, I could have been from Antarctica. I mean, it wouldn't have mattered. My parents, in my opinion, growing up, which I think was good, because I think it's helped me as an adult, but it's made it tough as a child, was that my parents did not raise me at all with any of my Vietnamese culture. There was zero, like you are one of us. Like you, yeah. Like you are one of us. So like, there's like, we don't see any difference between you, you know, and you are one of us. Right.
Which is a double-edged sword, of course, yes. Because that's yes. So you are, it's so loving. And then it's also like, oh, but you're not honoring where you're actually from. Yeah.
And you were in a small town.
We moved around Oklahoma quite a bit. And I wouldn't say a small town. Like, okay, I mean, probably, you know, I mean, sometimes I lived in Tulsa, which is a decent sized town. Sometimes we lived in, so we moved around a lot. So I wouldn't say that, I would not call it like I lived like rural, you know, where, you know, there was only like, you know, 10 kids in a classroom type thing. You know what I mean? But it was small townish Oklahoma at times, right? What I would say is the size of the town didn't matter how I was treated, right? So I was treated the same way whether I was in a big town or a small town by my
so school. And was that how, what was that experience like?
Well, so I will say, so you know, we were just touched on how I was raised basically as one of my parents' own, right? And so I grew up thinking and believing that I was the same as them. And I remember the first time, I mean, I knew that I was adopted, I knew it was Vietnamese, but I didn't know that children, kids could be such, you know, jerks, right? And so I remember we were out at the lake one time. I was probably like 7 or 8 years old, and I was playing with my brother and my sister, and some kids came up, and they started, this older boy started kind of, I don't remember what he said, but it was, but he was kind of making racial slurs about it, right? Wow. And it was at me, right? I was like, hold on, like time out, like why are you doing that to me? Like, we're on the same team here, guy. Like why
you're like, who are you looking at?
Me? Yeah, like I didn't understand it, right? Like we're on the same team here, you know. You got your you know, and it was the fact that I was Asian, right? And he was making jokes about it, right? And kind of picking on me.
Wow.
And so that was the first time that I can remember of being made fun of. And I think I was probably about 9 years old. And then as I got older, it escalated, right?
In high school years?
Oh, junior high, high school.
Like just the guys?
He's making fun of me, making jokes, making racial jokes and stuff. God. And so, but here's the deal. So if you ever met my family, and I'm going to like tread lightly here, but my family are pretty like, they're not passive people. They are assertive. And I would say they're beyond assertive, right? And so I was raised like that, right? So, it's kind of like you just don't take shit from people, right?
Yeah.
Thing. And so I was raised like that too. And so, I think you couple that on top of the fact that at some point in my childhood, I harnessed anger, right? Like I realized that anger was my friend. It, like anger kept me from feeling these emotions, this hurt, right? So I could like, instead of being, you know, hurt or sad or whatever it is, I could use anger as this tool to deal with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I fought a lot growing up. Like I would fight, like I was like all the time getting in fights with kids at school, right?
So scrappy.
Yeah, I don't know if it's scrappy. First of all, it's being an angry person anyway as a child.
Do you feel like your anger was definitely internal or was it learned? Like, do you know what I'm asking?
Both.
Okay.
I will say that my family as children were angry people, I think. I would say that. Yes, I will say that I'm angry people. So when my family calls me up, I will defend that. We were angry people, right? So, and on top of that, I was an angry child, I used anger as a way to avoid my feelings, my emotions, right? Not to have to deal with them. And so that fed in with my ability to kind of survive, right? And to, you know, and so when somebody would make fun of me or say something to me, you know, I was like, I'd fight them, right? Or I would try to fight them. And so that happened pretty regularly. I will say that as I got older, I was awkward. Like, so every once in a while I'll on Facebook, I'll post a picture of what I looked like as a kid. So up until maybe I was like 7 or 8 years old, I was thin as a rail. Right. And then probably up until I turned around 10, I kind of chubby and I had bad haircuts and just had zero game, right?
It's like you already have everything going on, then zero game with the haircuts.
Yeah. So it was pick this person that's in kind of a bad situation anyway, emotionally, and then let this happen to him, right? So it was definitely, I showed you a picture of what I looked like then, and I look now, who I am now, I definitely was what you would call a late bloomer, right? Yeah. I was like your cheese or wine that got better with age, right?
I hope you'll share about the meal your parents took.
Oh, yeah. So I was talking to my mom. So before I came on the podcast, I called my mom, like I said, and was asking her about, first of all, I was wanting to kind of clean up the timeline a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. But my mom and dad used to tell me this story that when I was about maybe about 2 years old, I think, they took me to a Mexican restaurant and for whatever reason, bought me an adult plate of food, right? You know, who buys a two-year-old adult by a plate of food? I mean, I thought you'd buy them those little, a taco and some Jello and they get, little placemat you can color on or something.
Yeah.
Maybe that didn't exist back in the 70s. So they bought me an adult plate of food and I guess I ate the entire thing, right? And so I got to say that when I first came here to the States, my mom said that I actually had a bloated stomach. My mom will say that I was an excellent eater, right? Like I ate everything you put in front of me. They found out that I had been hiding food in the mattress, not my mattress, box spring. So they said that I had cut open my box spring and was squirreling food away in there, like a chipmunk or something like that for wintertime.
Wow.
And so I don't remember this, but I will say that I am a person that when I was a child, whatever was put in front of me, I would eat it. The idea of not cleaning my plate, I wouldn't do that. Right. So for some period of my childhood, there was this underlying fear of, scarcity of food, So it's I think I was, somehow conditioned that when food was presented to me, I needed to eat it all because I don't know if I'm going to get another meal. Right.
Yeah.
That's probably lesser of my story as an adult, but it was something that my mom, my mom told me, she's like, you were a great eater.
Reading this book and just talking to adopted people and finding out how we cope mm-hmm. with feelings and people do it differently. There's the please or there's the this and there's the that, that dynamic of, so yours was to be angry and avoid. When did you finally connect the dots with, everybody has that maybe light bulb moment, oh my God, I was adopted and I finally understand why I went through this and went through that. But,
I think it was probably in the last 5 or 6 years, me and my wife were going through a separation. It forced me to really take a look at my stuff, right? Because like I said, it was deferred maintenance. I knew that there was things going on in me for a long time, emotions, feelings, and I've always been an emotional person, right? But I've also been a person for the longest time, wouldn't allow myself to drop down and experience those emotions, right? I used to tell this story that I'm talking to you about right now, being adopted, and I could tell it hundreds of times, right? But it was just factual. I was adopted. I was born in Vietnam, And I remember it's this good friend of mine. And I remember telling him the story. And then he just paused and he says, man, that story just speaks to me, And it's I forgot what he said, but basically the way he reacted to it was this, it was kind of he was telling me or signaling to me, it's okay to feel sad about that. because I'm sad about that. Hearing that story makes me sad. And so he didn't say that it was okay to be sad, but by hearing him be sad about it, I realized that it was okay to have those emotions about that story, right? Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it used to be like a factual train for you. And then all of a sudden someone's like touched by your story that you're kind of not letting that in.
I do suffer, like I said, from a lot of what other adopted children I suffer from, you know, like, you know, attachment and abandonment. Oh my God. Abandonment issues are just like, it's like, yeah, that's like the, like, that's like the, you know, bane of my existence, abandonment and, you know, and attachment. I'm the kid that would go to summer camp and like get home from summer camp and be devastated. Right. Cause I went to church summer camp and like, it was like, everything was so great. And when I got home, I was just like devastated. I easily can, if I allow myself, become attached to people, right? Or I can easily feel that somebody's going to abandon me, because that was what I experienced, you know, that whole thing. I was, you know, so I remember talking to this woman that worked at World Vision, right? I told you she worked at the orphanage. I remember calling her up. I was really excited. We had kind of started talking on Facebook and she was super nice. So I called her up and I'm just talking to her. And I remember asking her the story. Like, I remember like talking to her and I was like really curious on like how the children were treated in the orphanages. Cause I thought that was really important, you know? And by this time I've already had, you know, I've got three children. I've got a son named Dustin who, was my wife's, you know, he's not my biological son, but I, you know, raised him as my own since he was like a year and a half old. I've got a daughter who's 17 years old. Her name's Indigo. And I have a son, a 13-year-old named Cactus. And the funny thing is both Cactus and Indigo, their middle name is my first name. So it's Indigo Lee, L-Y, or Cactus Lee. And Cactus is not his given name, but it's his name, Cactus. Okay. So I am familiar with how people bond with their children. I've seen it firsthand, right? As being a father and seeing their mother bond with them through, you know, the childbirthing, that whole process, nurture, nature, it's all together, right? I remember asking this woman, I said, so I just have a quick question. I was like, did you guys ever hold those babies? You know, like hold them, love them. You might've been feeding them and you might've been taking care and changing their diapers, but you know, like, you know, you can imagine that these babies are scared, you know, and sad and lonely because they're like, we're taken away from wherever they're at, you know, and you know. So I remember asking her that, and she didn't know this, but I had my phone on silent because I was like crying as I was asking this question. Did you hold those babies? Like, that was like an important thing. She's like, yeah, we held those babies.
So, yeah, you wonder because you had a long time before you were with your family. So it's like, yeah. And
that's, you know, almost an older child
in a toddler.
Well, that is,
it's very important, you know, if you've gotten love or.
Yeah. I've been in a lot of therapy, like as an adult. God, like, you know, I've told Sarah, like, I could have bought a nice car for the amount of money that I spent on therapy, right? In fact, when I finish this podcast, I'm going to go see my therapist. And I love her to death. She's probably saved my life several times, literally and emotionally, physically, right? So, the other thing that I'm struggling with is that, you know, like inside me exists like this child, right? This child that's sad and scared and lonely, and it's touched all the time. You know, like if I allow it to be touched, you know, by people in my life or by life experiences. And one thing that I am trying to do as an adult is realize that at the end of the day, I'm the only person that to take care of that child. At the end of the day, I'm the only person that's going to be able to take care of that child that's at that orphanage crying. And I can remember, like, and I've done this. I've done like this projection where I like fall asleep and I'll be thinking about that baby. And like, I am there talking to that child and holding it and loving it and embracing it and telling you, like, I will never abandon you.
Oh, makes me cry.
That's really what it is. It's that for me, at least, it's like this constant fear of being abandoned. And I said, I can't figure this shit out. Like that I am the one that has to be there for myself, right? Because as much as you want to rely on somebody else that loves you, husbands, wives, children, they can all be taken away from you.
They can't fill that. That's
right. They cannot.
It takes a long time to figure that out.
Yeah. And so and I'm still figuring it out. You know, yeah. I sleep with a teddy bear. So I was in the Navy. I have my dog tags from when I was in the Navy. And so I've got this teddy bear that I sleep with that has about my dog tags on. This is, you know, it's John Fry. And so in that teddy bear is me. You know, at the end of the day, when I'm alone, I don't have anybody else, I fall asleep, you know, holding this teddy bear.
That's beautiful.
I was recently on travel for work. I left my teddy bear in a hotel room, right? And the people called me and they're like, "We found a bear in your room, but it seems like it's probably a pretty important thing, right?" Because they figured it out, right? So I called my coworker who was up in the area and I said, "Hey, I need you to go get my bear for me."
Like, "Can you get my teddy bear?"
He was totally cool with it. He was totally cool with it, you know? Like,
whatever you got to do, dude. Yeah. Whatever you got to do, dude.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, yeah. Right, so I don't know. I don't know where we're at as far as my story. I will say that as an adult, I'm okay with being Vietnamese. Like that's like, I am totally, in fact, it's probably served me well being Vietnamese, being Asian. At various times in my life, when I have longer hair, I get mistaken for other nationalities, right? So growing up in Oklahoma, I would pretend like I was Native American when I would meet people. Because it was more acceptable to be Native American than Asian at times, right? So
that's America. America.
So I would blend in as a Native American out in the West, like Arizona or in that, you know, in that area. You know, there's a lot of Native Americans out there, so I blend in very well there. When I'm in visiting Mexico, I can kind of pass myself off as Mexican, right? So the joke is, I have a good friend of mine, and he's like, "So you're like the Lou Diamond Phillips, right?"
Yeah, I was gonna say that.
Yeah, like, what is Lou Diamond Phillips? I mean, like, you kind of know what he is, but you kind of don't, right?
He plays so many roles.
Yeah, and like jokingly, I can like, I have like at least 3 months I get to celebrate at work. You know, I work for the government, so like, you know, they're very diverse, and you know, they promote a diverse workforce, and so you know, I'm like a, you know, I get like, I get Native American month, I get Hispanic month, and I get Asia Pacific Islander month. So I get to celebrate lots of months, right? They get to count me a bunch of times. You know, they get
When you went to Vietnam, did you find anything out about your birth mother?
So I went to Vietnam, do not speak Vietnamese. I'm 5'10". I probably weigh about 180, 85 pounds, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how many Vietnamese friends you have.
Yeah. But like, you're not the norm.
When I was there, I kind of stood out.
Maybe I've asked you this before, but I wonder if your birth father was like a GI.
Nope. I've already gone down that road. I did the 23andMe. And yeah, I was hoping that my birth father was British. Then I could like go around and try to speak with a British accent, right? That's what I found out today. But no, I'm not. I like about 2 or 3 years ago, I did the 23andMe and I am straight up, no bones about it, Asian, right? So, yeah. Asian. So, yeah, I was hoping like something exotic, you know, like Swiss or.
Oh, yeah.
No, it wasn't it. I will tell you this, going back to Vietnam was emotionally, I thought it was going to be more healing than it was.
Hmm.
It wasn't as healing that I was hoping it would be. When you don't know the answer to something, and you can make up your own answer in your head, like the whole GI thing, right? Like, oh, that's why I'm so tall. I obviously am half, you know, French, Canadian, German, whatever GI was there, right? But that's not the truth. And so I think part of not wanting to go back to Vietnam was I could make up my own stories. I could construct my own reality in my head about what it was going to be like going back there, right? Because I really thought going back there was going to be this like groundbreaking thing. And it wasn't. It was actually really hard. Not speaking the language. It's a culture that's totally unlike our Western culture. And I didn't have a translator. I was alone. I did a lot of traveling. I wrote a little blog when I was there. I was writing some little blogs, and I would meet women all the time, like as I was walking along, and I would, you know, you're like, I'd be, could that be my mom? Could that be my mom? You know,
yeah.
like I'd be like looking at people. I was like, could that be my mom? You know, just like things like that. I think sometimes when I would speak to people, there was an expectation that I would be able to speak Vietnamese, and I didn't. And so it was like truly a stranger in a strange land, right?
Yeah.
And then also going back to Vietnam, I had survivor's guilt, right? So my having come here and, you know, where we're at in this world and the life we live is really luck of the draw, right?
Yes.
It's really luck, you know, and I just, you know, I guess you could say that I won the lottery by being able to be on that plane and come here, you know, and living the life I have. But I've also wondered, like, what would have my life been if I stayed in Vietnam, you know, and what would that have looked like for me? Maybe I wouldn't have had good health care. Maybe my teeth wouldn't be as bad as they are now, you know, like maybe a little bit worse than they are now. Maybe my nutrition would be different. But, you know, I would have been with, I guess, my people, you know, I would have been in my culture.
Yeah.
So you don't know, right? I did experience survivor's guilt when I was there because I saw there's still extreme poverty in Vietnam, right? Yeah. I'm guessing being an orphan, chances of being successful are going to probably be less, you know, than coming from family and, you know, being raised in the orphanage and stuff. I went down to that town where I was born at, Kinto, and hung around there for a while. But, you know, in the end, it did not provide me the closure that I thought it might.
Yeah.
And so that was a little disappointing. I expended a lot of emotional capital to go back to Vietnam. You know, it wasn't what I was hoping it was.
You know, with advances in technology or whatever, it might still be that you'll find somebody at some point if you want to.
I've thought about that, you know. So, like, you know, I've heard your guys's, you know, I remember when my daughter Indigo was born. I have an adopted son, Dustin, who's my wife's biological son. And so for the first 10 years of his life, he was an only child. And I went to great. So, like, I had really struggled with wanting to have my own biological child, right? First of all, being an adopted child, I never wanted to send any kind of signals to Dustin that he was any less than, right?
Yeah.
And so I went to great lengths. You know, it was a lot of discernment before, you know, we went down this road of having, my own biological child. And so when Indigo was born, I can remember when she was born, I was like so excited. And then I like ran away to the bathroom and just cried, right? Because, and then, like, it was like, finally, I was not alone. And I know that I was not alone, you know, like. And I remember posting that on Facebook a couple of years ago. Like, every time she has a birthday, I'm like, you know, I'll say, hey, like, you have no idea how much I love you and how much you mean to me. And that, you know, up until your birth, I was really alone. Because you guys have talked about this. My brother, my adopted brother, can see himself in my father, can see himself in my mom, our younger sister, Sarah. You guys talked about this. You see the euphemism. You see, like, little traits, characteristics, you know, that we pick up. That's, I think, it's nurture and nature, right? That are there.
Yeah.
And being adopted, not having anybody like that was, you know, like, I didn't have that, right? I have no family history, like zero, you know. So that's easy. Like, whenever I go to the doctor, they're like, "Do you have any family history of cancer?"
Nope.
Nope. I can just, like, mark them really quick, right? So. So, you know, so it is kind of beneficial sometimes. But when my daughter was born, yes, I was not alone. I was no longer alone. And I will also say that it's probably one of the first times in my life, after holding her and carrying her and caring for her, that I was able to really to experience love. Right.
Yeah.
Because
we both,
I was giving love. There was this thing, there's this child that, you know, like, I unconditionally, like it was like, I didn't have to be taught it. It was just like instinctual. Like, you know, like, I love this thing. Right. Like, I love this child. Right. That was helpful in me being able to, I still have a hard time accepting love. I still have a hard time receiving it, but I'm definitely better for it having Indigo. And I also have a son, Cactus. He's like I said, he's 13, and he is also, you know, I have similar bond with him. But since he came in second, it wasn't as groundbreaking with him as it was my daughter Indigo.
Yeah.
So I definitely have I won't say stronger bond. I have a different bond with her than I have with my son. It's no less more, or it's just, it's different. right?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so this has just been, I know, we're like, we could talk all night or ask questions over and over, but we have to wrap it up at some point, I think. This has just been, I mean, hearing you talk is really emotional.
Yeah, very emotional. I'm just like blown away. You're an amazing person too.
Thank you. I mean, I think, you know, Sarah said this, everybody has a story to tell, right?
Yes.
I don't know if everybody has a story to tell, you know, and I think it's also like, you know, like how they tell it, you know, so some people have, you know, maybe a not as good of a story, but are able to tell their story better. But this is a story that I've always been able to tell the story, but to be able to tell the story and experience the emotions that are associated with it for me is more important than telling the story. You know,
Well, it sounds like you are, maybe nobody would describe themselves as like emotionally healthy, but it certainly sounds like you have a healthy way of looking at things, and the way you're trying to address these issues is, you know, head on. It's a scary, scary thing. And it's really impressive to do that. Wow. It's hard. You know, many people just run away from it. Myself included have done run away so much in my own life. So hearing you be so vulnerable and talk so honestly and has been really great. It's been really, I feel like
I feel enriched.
I feel really lucky to have you on this podcast.
Me too. I feel enriched from this experience.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm very happy to have been a part of what you guys are doing here and stuff. I hope it's beneficial to, you know, somebody out there.
I think it would be beneficial to others.
You know,
definitely think so. I think a lot of people are going to really feel a lot when they hear this story.
I do too.
Okay. Well,
on that note,
thank you for having me.
Thank you, John.
John, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Listening to this now, almost 3 years later, and it's still just as powerful.
It makes sure me
want to reach out to John. It's been a
me
minute.
Me too. Yeah. Shout out, John, if you see this on again, because that just brought back a lot of memories of where we were. And also his story, I mean, is just huge for people. You know, there's so many people that have suffered this who've never talked about it, who I think if they didn't start with us in season one, maybe finding the podcast now, or maybe it's been so long you don't remember it. I just think it's very powerful.
I agree. Okay. Well, Louise.
What do we say?
Another great episode.
Sure was. Another great episode.
Thanks so much for listening today.
And remember, if you'd like to share your stories or suggest any guests for our show, you can find us on all the socials at The Making of Me Podcast.
And again, we have a Patreon page so that we can continue to bring these great adoption stories to you. So if you want to find that and donate or contribute in any way, find us at patreon.com searching adoption: The Making of Me.
Bye.
See you next time.